Chapter 2. His heart was beating so violently that he was giddy, and everything was green before his eyes. Mechanically, he busied himself arranging his scanty belongings in his new lodgings. He undid the bag containing various necessary possessions, opened the box containing his books, and began laying them out on the table. But soon all this work dropped from his hands. Every minute there rose before his eyes the image of the woman, the meeting with whom had so troubled and disturbed his whole existence, who had filled his heart with such irresistible, violent ecstasy, and such happiness seemed at once flooding his starved life that his thoughts grew dizzy and his soul swooned in anguish and perplexity. He took his passport and carried it to the landlord in the hope of getting a glance at her, but Morin scarcely opened the door. He took the paper from him, said, "Good, live in peace," and closed the door again. An unpleasant feeling came over Ardinov. He did not know why, but it was irksome for him to look at the old man. There was something spiteful and contemptuous in his eyes, but the unpleasant impression quickly passed off. For the last 3 days, Ardinov had, in comparison with his former stagnation, been living in a whirl of life. But he could not reflect. He was, indeed, afraid to. His whole existence was in a state of upheaval and chaos. He dimly felt as though his life had been broken in half. One yearning, one expectation possessed him, and no other thoughts troubled him. In perplexity, he went back to his room. There, by the stove in which the cooking was done, a little hump-backed old woman was busily at work, so filthy and clothed in such rags that she was a pitiful sight. She seemed very ill-humoured and grumbled to herself at times, mumbling with her lips. She was his landlord's servant. Ardinov tried to talk to her, but she would not speak, evidently from ill-humour. At last, dinner-time arrived. The old woman took cabbage soup, pies, and beef out of the oven, and took them to her master and mistress. She gave some of the same to Ardinov. After dinner, there was a death-like silence in the flat. Ardinov took up a book and spent a long time turning over its pages, trying to follow the meaning of what he had read often before. Losing patience, he threw down the book and began again putting his room to rights. At last he took up his cap, put on his coat, and went out into the street. Walking at hazard, without seeing the road, he still tried as far as he could to concentrate his mind, to collect his scattered thoughts, and to reflect a little upon his position. But the effort only reduced him to misery, to torture. He was attacked by fever and chills alternately, and at times his heart beat so violently that he had to support himself against the wall. "No, better death," he thought. "Better death," he whispered, with feverish, trembling lips, hardly thinking of what he was saying. He walked for a very long time, at last feeling that he was soaked to the skin, and noticing for the first time that it was pouring with rain, he returned home. Not far from home he saw his porter. He fancied that the Tartar stared at him for some time with curiosity, and then went his way when he noticed that he had been seen. "Good morning," said Ardinov, overtaking him. "What are you called?" "Folks call me Porter," he answered, grinning. "Have you been Porter here long?"
"Yes."
"Is my landlord an artisan?"
"Yes, if he says so."
"What does he do?"
"He is ill. Lives, praise to God. That's all."
"Is that his wife?"
"What wife?"
"Who lives with him?"
"Yes, if he says so."
"Goodbye, sir." The Tartar touched his cap and went off to his den. Ardinov went to his room. The old woman, mumbling and grumbling to herself, opened the door to him, fastened it again with the latch, and again climbed on the stove where she spent her life. It was already getting dark. Ardinov was going to get a light when he noticed that the door to the landlord's room was locked. He called the old woman, who, propping herself on her elbow, looked sharply at him from the stove, as though wondering what he wanted with the landlord's lock. She threw him a box of matches without a word. He went back into his room and again, for the 100th time, tried to busy himself with his books and things. But, little by little, without understanding what he was doing, he sat down on the locker, and it seemed to him that he fell asleep. At times he came to himself and realized that his sleep was not sleep, but the agonizing unconsciousness of illness. He heard a knock at the door, heard it opened, and guessed that it was the landlord and landlady returning from evening service. At that point it occurred to him that he must go into them for something. He stood up, and it seemed to him that he was already going to them, but stumbled and fell over a heap of firewood which the old woman had flung down in the middle of the floor. At that point he lost consciousness completely, and opening his eyes after a long, long time, noticed with surprise that he was lying on the same locker, just as he was, in his clothes, and that over him there bent with tender solicitude a woman's face, divinely, beautiful, and, it seemed, drenched with gentle, motherly tears. He felt her put a pillow under his head and lay something warm over him, and some tender hand was laid on his feverish brow. He wanted to say thank you. He wanted to take that hand, to press it to his parched lips, to wet it with his tears, to kiss it to all eternity. He wanted to say a great deal, but what, he did not know himself. He would have been glad to die at that instant, but his arms felt like lead and would not move. He was, as it were, numb, and felt nothing but the blood pulsing through his veins, with throbs which seemed to lift him up as he lay in bed. Somebody gave him water. At last, he fell into unconsciousness. He woke up at 8 o'clock in the morning. The sunshine was pouring through the green, mouldy windows in a sheaf of golden rays. A feeling of comfort relaxed the sick man's limbs. He was quiet and calm, infinitely happy. It seemed to him that someone had just been by his pillow. He woke up, looking anxiously around him for that unseen being. He so longed to embrace his friend, and for the first time in his life to say, "A happy day to you, my dear one." "What a long time you have been asleep," said a woman's gentle voice. Ardinov looked round, and the face of his beautiful landlady was bending over him with a friendly smile as clear as sunlight. "How long you have been ill," she said. "It's enough. Get up. Why keep yourself in bondage? Freedom is sweeter than bread, fairer than sunshine. Get up, my dove, get up." Ardinov seized her hand and pressed it warmly. It seemed to him that he was still dreaming. "Wait, I've made tea for you. Do you want some tea? You had better have some, you'll be better. I've been ill myself, and I know." "Yes, give me something to drink," said Ardinov in a faint voice, and he got up on his feet. He was still very weak. A chill ran down his spine. All his limbs ached and felt as though they were broken. But there was a radiance in his heart, and the sunlight seemed to warm him with a sort of solemn, serene joy. He felt that a new, intense, incredible life was beginning for him. His head was in a slight whirl. "Your name is Vasily?" she asked. "Either I have made a mistake, or I fancy the master called you that yesterday." "Yes, it is. And what is your name?" said Ardinov, going nearer to her, and hardly able to stand on his feet. He staggered. She caught him by the arm and laughed. "My name is Katerina," she said, looking into his face with her large, clear blue eyes. They were holding each other by the hands. "You want to say something to me?" she said at last.
"I don't know," answered Ardinoff.
Everything was dark before his eyes.
"See what a state you're in. There, my dove, there. Don't grieve, don't pine. Sit here at the table in the sun.
Sit quiet and don't follow me," she added, seeing that the young man made a movement as though to keep her. "I will be with you again at once. You have plenty of time to see as much as you want of me." A minute later, she brought in the tea, put it on the table, and sat down opposite him.
"Come, drink it up," she said. "Does your head ache?"
"No, now it doesn't ache," he said. "I don't know.
Perhaps it does. I don't want any. Enough, enough. I don't know what's the matter with me," he said, breathless and finding her hand at last.
"Stay here. Don't go away from me. Give me your hand again. It's all dark before my eyes. I look at you as though you were the sun," he said, as it were tearing the words out of his heart and almost swooning with ecstasy as he uttered them. His throat was choking with sobs.
"Poor fellow! It seems you have not lived with anyone kind. You are all lonely and forlorn. Haven't you any relations?"
"No, no one. I'm alone. Never mind, it's no matter. Now it's better. I'm all right now," said Ardinoff, as though in delirium. The room seemed to him to be going round.
"I too have not seen my people for many years. You look at me as," she said after a minute's silence.
"Well?"
"What?"
"You look at me as though my eyes were warming you. You know, when you love anyone, I took you to my heart from the first word. If you are ill, I will look after you again. Only don't you be ill. No. When you get up, we will live like brother and sister. Will you? You know it's difficult to get a sister if God has not given you one."
"Who are you? Where do you come from?" said Ardinoff in a weak voice.
"I am not of these parts. You know the folks tell how 12 brothers lived in a dark forest, and how a fair maiden lost her way in that forest. She went to them and tidied everything in the house for them, and put her love into everything. The brothers came home and learned that the sister had spent the day there. They began calling her. She came out to them. They all called her sister, gave her freedom, and she was equal with all. Do you know the fairy tale?"
"I know it," whispered Ardinoff. "Life is sweet.
Is it sweet to you to live in the world?"
"Yes, yes, to live for a long time, to live for ages," answered Ardinoff.
"I don't know," said Katharina dreamily. "I should like death, too. Is life sweet? To love and to love good people, yes. Look, you've turned as white as flour again."
"Yes, my head's going round."
"Stay. I will bring you my bedclothes and another pillow. I will make up the bed here. Sleep and dream of me. Your weakness will pass. Our old woman is ill, too."
While she talked, she began making the bed, from time to time looking at Ardinoff with a smile.
"What a lot of books you've got," she said, moving away a box.
She went up to him, took him by the right arm, led him to the bed, tucked him up, and covered him with the quilt.
"They say books spoil a man," she said, shaking her head thoughtfully. "Do you like reading?"
"Yes," answered Ardinoff, not knowing whether he were asleep or awake,
and pressing Katharina's hand tight to assure himself that he was awake.
"My master has a lot of books. You should see. He says they are religious books. He's always reading to me out of them. I will show you afterwards. You shall tell me afterwards what he reads to me out of them."
"Tell me," whispered Ardinoff, keeping his eyes fixed on her.
"Are you fond of praying?" she said to him after a moment's silence. "Do you know, I'm afraid. I'm always afraid."
She did not finish. She seemed to be meditating. At last, Ordynov raised her hand to his lips.
"Why are you kissing my hand?"
And her cheeks flushed faintly crimson.
"Here, kiss them," she said, laughing and holding out both hands to him.
Then she took one away and laid it on his burning forehead. Then she began to stroke and arrange his hair. She flushed more and more. At last, she sat down on the floor by his bedside and laid her cheek against his cheek. Her warm, damp breath tickled his face. At last, Ordynov felt a gush of hot tears fall from her eyes like molten lead on his cheeks. He felt weaker and weaker. He was too faint to move a hand. At that moment, there was a knock at the door, followed by the grating of the bolt. Ordynov could hear the old man, his landlord, come in from the other side of the partition. Then he heard Katerina get up, without haste and without listening, take her books. He felt her make the sign of the cross over him as she went out. He closed his eyes. Suddenly, a long, burning kiss scorched his feverish lips. It was like a knife thrust into his heart. He uttered a faint shriek and sank into unconsciousness. Then a strange life began for him. In moments when his mind was not clear, the thought flashed upon him that he was condemned to live in a long, unending dream, full of strange, fruitless agitations, struggles, and sufferings. In terror, he tried to resist the disastrous fatalism that weighed upon him, and at a moment of tense and desperate conflict, some unknown force struck him again, and he felt clearly that he was once more losing memory, that an impassable, bottomless abyss was opening before him, and he was flinging himself into it with a wail of anguish and despair. At times he had moments of insufferable, devastating happiness, when the life force quickens convulsively in the whole organism, when the past shines clear, when the present glad moment resounds with triumph and one dreams awake of a future beyond all ken, when a hope beyond words falls with life-giving dew on the soul, when one wants to scream with ecstasy, when one feels that the flesh is too weak for such a mass of impressions, that the whole thread of existence is breaking, and yet, at the same time, one greets all one's life with hope and renewal. At times he sank into lethargy, and then everything that had happened to him in the last few days was repeated again, and passed across his mind in a swarm of broken, vague images. But his visions came in strange and enigmatic form. At times the sick man forgot what had happened to him, and wondered that he was not in his old lodging with his old landlady. He could not understand why the old woman did not come as she always used at the twilight hour to the stove, which from time to time flooded the whole dark corner of the room with a faint flickering glow, to warm her trembling bony hands at the dying embers before the fire went out, always talking and whispering to herself, and sometimes looking at him, her strange lodger, who had, she thought, grown mad by sitting so long over his books. Another time he would remember that he had moved into another lodging, but how it had happened, what was the matter with him, and why he had to move, he did not know, though his whole soul was swooning in continual, irresistible yearning. But to what end? What led him on and tortured him, and who had kindled this terrible flame that stifled him and consumed his blood? Again, he did not know and could not remember. Often he greedily clutched at some shadow. Often he heard the rustle of light footsteps near his bed, and a whisper, sweet as music, of tender, caressing words.
Someone's moist and uneven breathing passed over his face, thrilling his whole being with love. Hot tears dropped upon his feverish cheeks, and suddenly a long, tender kiss was printed on his lips. Then his life lay languishing in unquenchable torture. All existence, the whole world, seemed standing still, seemed to be dying for ages around him, and everything seemed shrouded in a long night of 1,000 years. Then the tender, calmly flowing years of early childhood seemed coming back to him again with serene joy, with the inextinguishable happiness, the first sweet wonder of life, with the swarms of bright spirits that fluttered under every flower he picked, that sported with him on the luxuriant green meadow before the little house among the acacias, that smiled at him from the immense crystal lake beside which he would sit for hours together, listening to the plashing of the waves that rustled about him with their wings, lovingly scattering bright rainbow dreams upon his little cot, while his mother, bending over him, made the sign of the cross, kissed him, and sang him sweet lullabies in the long, peaceful nights. But then a being suddenly began to appear who overwhelmed him with a childlike terror, first bringing into his life the slow poison of sorrow and tears. He dimly felt that an unknown old man held all his future years in thrall, and, trembling, he could not turn his eyes away from him. The wicked old man followed him about everywhere. He peeped out and treacherously nodded to the boy from under every bush in the copse, laughed and mocked at him, took the shape of every doll, grimacing and laughing in his hands, like a spiteful, evil gnome. He set every one of the child's inhuman schoolfellows against him, or, sitting with the little ones on the school bench, peeped out, grimacing from every letter of his grammar. Then, when he was asleep, the evil old man sat by his pillow. He drove away the bright spirits whose gold and sapphire wings rustled about his cot, carried off his poor mother from him forever, and began whispering to him every night long, wonderful fairy tales, unintelligible to his childish imagination, but thrilling and tormenting him with terror and unchildlike passion. But the wicked old man did not heed his sobs and entreaties, and would go on talking to him till he sank into numbness, into unconsciousness. Then the child suddenly woke up a man. The years passed over him unseen, unheeded. He suddenly became aware of his real position. He understood all at once that he was alone, an alien to all the world, alone in a corner not his own, among mysterious and suspicious people, among enemies who were always gathering together and whispering in the corners of his dark room and nodding to the old woman squatting on her heels near the fire, warming her bony old hands and pointing to him. He sank into perplexity and uneasiness. He wanted to know who these people were, why they were here, why he was himself in this room, and guessed that he had strayed into some dark den of miscreants, drawn on by some powerful but incomprehensible force, without having first found out who and what the tenants were, and who his landlord was. He began to be tortured by suspicion, and suddenly, in the stillness of the night, again there began a long, whispered story, and some old woman, mournfully nodding her white, grizzled head before the dying fire, was muttering it softly, hardly audibly, to herself. But, and again he was overcome with horror, the story took shape before him in forms and faces. He saw everything, from his dim, childish visions upwards. All his thoughts and dreams, all his experiences in life, all he had read in books, things he had forgotten long ago, all were coming to life, all were being put together, taking shape and rising up before him in colossal forms and images, moving and swarming about him. He saw spread out before him magnificent, enchanted gardens, a whole town built up and demolished before his eyes, a whole churchyard giving up its dead, who began living over again. Whole races and peoples came into being and passed away before his eyes. Finally, every one of his thoughts, every immaterial fancy, now took bodily shape around his sickbed, took bodily shape almost at the moment of its conception. At last, he saw himself thinking not in immaterial ideas, but in whole worlds, whole creations, saw himself borne along like an atom in this infinite, strange world from which there was no escape, and all this life, in its mutinous independence, crushing and oppressing him and pursuing him with eternal, infinite irony. He felt that he was dying, dissolving into dust and ashes forever, and even without hope of resurrection, he tried to flee, but there was no corner in all the universe to hide him. At last, in an access of despair, he made an intense effort, uttered a shriek, and woke up. He woke up, bathed in a chill, icy sweat. Around him was a deadly silence. It was the dead of night. But still it seemed to him that somewhere the wonderful fairy tale was going on, that some hoarse voice was really telling a long story of something that seemed familiar to him. He heard talk of dark forests, of bold brigands, of some daring bravos, maybe of Stenka Razin himself, of merry drunken bargemen, of some fair maiden, and of Mother Volga. Was it not a fairy tale? Was he really hearing it? For a whole hour he lay open-eyed, without stirring a muscle, in agonizing numbness. At last he got up carefully and joyfully felt that his strength had come back to him after his severe illness. The delirium was over, and reality was beginning. He noticed that he was dressed exactly as he had been during his talk with Katerina, so that it could not have been long since the morning she had left him. The fire of resolution ran through his veins. Mechanically, he felt with his hand for a big nail, for some reason driven into the top of the partition near which stood his bed, seized it, and hanging his whole weight upon it, succeeded in pulling himself up to the crevice from which a hardly perceptible light stole into his room. He put his eye to the opening, and, almost breathless with excitement, began peeping in. There was a bed in the corner of the landlord's room. Before it was a table covered with a cloth and piled up with books of old-fashioned shape, looking from their bindings like devotional books. In the corner was an icon of the same old-fashioned pattern as in his room. A lamp was burning before it. On the bed lay the old man, Murin, sick, worn out with suffering, and pale as a sheet, covered with a fur rag. On his knees was an open book. On a bench beside the bed lay Katerina, with her arm about the old man's chest and her head bent on his shoulder. She was looking at him with attentive, childishly wondering eyes, and seemed breathless with expectation to be listening with insatiable curiosity to what Murin was telling her. From time to time the speaker's voice rose higher. There was a shade of animation on his pale face. He frowned. His eyes began to flash, and Katerina seemed to turn pale with dread and expectation. Then something like a smile came into the old man's face, and Katerina began laughing softly. Sometimes tears came into her eyes. Then the old man tenderly stroked her on the head like a child, and she embraced him more tightly than ever with her bare arm that gleamed like snow, and nestled even more lovingly to his bosom. At times, Ordynov still thought this was part of his dream. In fact, he was convinced of it. But the blood rushed to his head, and the veins throbbed painfully in his temples. He let go of the nail, got off the bed,
and staggering, feeling his way like a lunatic, without understanding the impulse that flamed up like fire in his blood, he went to the door and pushed violently. The rusty bolt flew open at once, and with a bang and a crash, he suddenly found himself in the middle of the landlord's bedroom. He saw Katerina start and tremble, saw the old man's eyes flash angrily under his lowering brows, and his whole face contorted with sudden fury. He saw the old man, still keeping close watch upon him, feel hurriedly with fumbling hand for a gun that hung upon the wall. Then he saw the barrel of the gun flash, aimed straight at his breast with an uncertain hand that trembled with fury. There was the sound of a shot, then a wild, almost unhuman scream. And when the smoke parted, a terrible sight met Ordenov's eyes. Trembling all over, he bent over the old man. Murin was lying on the floor. He was writhing in convulsions. His face was contorted in agony, and there was foam upon his working lips. Ordenov guessed that the unhappy man was in a severe epileptic fit. He flew, together with Katerina, to help him.